Hello everyone and welcome to Shedcast 8B, A Sense of England, Consciousness. In 8A, we set out something of the historiography of nationalism. We ended with constipation, or rather, the removal of the blockage that had hampered debate, by deciding we should stop worrying about what historians of the modern era would think, and just let us medievalists think about the question of national consciousness on its own merits. And we summarised some of the key moments medieval historians consider on their way to the year 1500, the unification of Anglo-Saxon England, the Norman conquest, the loss of Normandy, the Hundred Years' War. Now that debate is once again allowed, begin to join it. Hurrah! I hear you cheer and throw your cap in the air. Our task, should you choose to accept it, is to decide if England can be described as a nation by 1500 on the threshold of the modern era. First of all, let us review the test that we will need to apply. How will we know if England is buzzing with a sense of Englishness by 1500? And secondly, we can have a catch-up of some of the major milestones to our period. And then, finally, after all this preamble and messing about, a bit like the process our dog goes through when making his bed on our best sofa, we can enter the detailed discussion and construct an answer. So, what are we looking for? Well, I think we need to answer the criticisms of modernists to some degree. This means six tests. Number one, nations have a clearly defined territory that everyone understands. No good wandering around asking, "Where is my fatherland? I must have taken a wrong turn. Oh, tell me where it is." How far is this true of England? Number two, is there really a loyalty to something called England felt by her citizens? According to the knobbly modernists, there are far too many regional loyalties in the days medieval. Number three, was it clear what it meant to be English? Is there a shared story, a shared set of characteristics that people recognise? Number four, language. There seems to be an assumption that language and nationality are closely aligned. Does England have a national language that binds it? And what about a national church? Number five, the killer objection from your modernist, that most people, if they felt part of anything bigger, felt part of Christendom rather than any grubby English nation. And lastly, number six, was there a political community worth the name? Or really, are we just talking about a few folk at the very top? So let's start with number one, where England was, exactly. Sounds like a jolly obvious question. In the North Sea, mate. But for most of the Middle Ages, the King of England, of course, rules a sort of collection of territories. Lord of Ireland, Prince of Wales, Duke of Gascony, da da da. If you happen to be called Edward I, you also claim to be King of Scotland. Sorry about that, by the way. Awkward. These days, the question, where is England, can also cause some trouble. So one of the delightful, innocent pleasures is when someone from outside these islands all innocently talks to, let's say, a Scot and refers to them as English rather than British or Scottish, always a hoot watching the kettle boil. Although with the effective death of the concept of Britain, that does leave the English a bit high and dry, of course, but that's another debate for another place and time. Officially, at least, through the Middle Ages, it's quite clear that England, Ireland, Wales, Gascony, and indeed the Channel Islands, are different places. So, for example, there are completely different offices to hear petitions from people from those places. Any potential confusion actually lay with the role of the king, being king of more than one place, although, as I say, actually, they weren't king of Ireland until 1540-something. They were lord of Ireland. Before I wrote this episode, I had to say that I assumed that the way this was dealt with was that the king had one kingdom, but multiple nations. That appears not to be the case. In fact, the word regnum, kingdom, gets used almost synonymously with England. The point about this is that there is a similar confusion between Britain and England as happens now. The way the words are used are not always terribly clear and precise, and can be used interchangeably. So just like now, sometimes people will say England, when actually what they mean is Britain. Actually, this is rather useful to the English crown. You'll remember the British creation myth in part one. Well, these confusions between Britain and England helped that critical theft of the old British myths by the English. It's also reflected in a certain fuzziness around the edges of the physical borders of England. And some of this is simply what the Middle Ages is like. The town of Berwick, for example, changes hands constantly between England and Scotland until Richard of Gloucester settles the question once and for all. the Anglo-Welsh border was terribly unclear. Though interestingly, of course, even though Wales becomes annexed to the English crown, no one for a moment thought it therefore became English. It retained its laws and customs and names. Aha! I hear you say. So, nobody's terribly clear about exactly where England is. That sounds like an argument against an English consciousness. Yep, fair point, I think. But not to be taken too far. Because it's absolutely clear about what the components of Britain are. It's clear from both sides that the Celtic Irish, Scots, Welsh and English are different from each other and feel different from each other. There are a series of articles by a historian called R.R. Davis that clarify that one of the ways this happens is through resistance to and hatred of the English by these Celtic nations. So, nothing new there then. Another factor is law. Law seems to hold a key place in the definition of difference and identity, particularly amongst the Celtic Irish and Welsh. And the same holds true to a degree from the English in the sense that there is a very clearly expressed view that English law and liberties are a central part of what makes England what it is. There's no great love of the law, of course, though the English are clearly very litigious indeed in the Middle Ages. The law is a machine, a tool, it does things, many of them unpleasant. But it is English law. And every Englishman, Welshman, Irishman and Scot has the right to their own version. The law may be an ass, but it's my ass. The English, meanwhile, are very clear that they are different to other nations as well. So, the Statute of Kilkenny, of course, embeds this even in law in Ireland. That statute decreed that the Anglo-Irish must maintain their difference in customs, speech and dress. Essentially, as regards the Welsh and Irish, the English hold on quite firmly to the belief that they're barbaric and backwards, that this owes nothing to the lack of resources and everything to an essential idleness. While the English wax lyrical about their own countryside, Wales, Ireland and Scotland are described as harsh, inhospitable places. Here's a nice 12th century anecdote. It's a sermon, and it tells a story of an English nobleman who shares out his lands between his sons. To his greedy eldest son, he left his lands in England, quote, because it is a land of peace and justice, and in it you will not be able to plunder unpunished. To his much couther, sociable and civilised younger son, why is it so often that the younger son is so much more civilised than the elder, I wonder? So true, though. Anyway, to his younger son, he gives lands in Wales, quote, which is a land of discord and war, because by your care you will moderate the wickedness of its inhabitants. So my point with all of this first section is that while the physical boundaries between England and other British nations are sometimes fuzzy, that while England and Britain can sometimes be used interchangeably, in everyone's minds there was no confusion. They all felt different to each other. The Celts hated the English looked down on the Celts. If xenophobia on its own is a definition of nationhood, we can probably end the podcast right here. We can also be comfortable that the English not only knew where their territory was, they clearly loved it. They felt emotionally connected with it. The way that the land of England is described by the literature of the English is interesting in that it is almost uniformly positive. The English took great pride in the richness and fertility of the land. It is portrayed as an almost miraculously fruitful place. No one complains that it's grey, damp and miserable most of the winter. Take note, my fellow citizens, take note and reform. Writers also celebrated the wonderful English management of this bounty, in stark contrast to the opinion of those Italian visitors we heard about recently, who described the average English farmer as hideously lazy. There's another angle also to all of this, which is that the land is more than simply soil and grass and trees and physical stuff. Frequently, the literature makes clear that there's an emotional connection between the land and the people. So that sermon we just covered, the land and the people have connected characteristics. When Piers Gaveston dies in 1312, there's one commentary here. The land rejoiced, and all its inhabitants were glad. The land rejoices, its inhabitants rejoice. England is almost a person. On hearing of Bannockburn, quote, England is tormented with very much grief that she is deprived of her honour by such craftiness. England feels the same way, incidentally, when it is thoughtlessly and comprehensively crushed by Indian cricket in a series of test matches and one-dayers. The land groans. But hopefully you see the point. There's an emotional connection between people and their land. England is a character. It's a feature that would suit all those romantic poets wandering over the countryside with a beatific expression and a hashpipe, or a 19th century German romantic poet sighing for the unification of their divided land. To summarise our point one then, is there a defined territory? Yes, there is. By 1500, England is a measurable place, or at least its inhabitants believe that it is, despite the demonstrable fuzziness at the edges. It's also a source of pride to the people who live there, and broadly speaking, maybe with the exception of Birmingham's bullring, so it has remained. Next, to our second point. Surely in medieval times, regional loyalties are far stronger than central ones. To test this, I suppose the question we need to ask is, could we conceive of England being happily carved up into different bits? This is, after all, what happens in early medieval France for a while. A modernist might well argue that all the way through the Middle Ages, kingdoms are dynastic, wars are dynastic. These countries are owned by families, and they can subdivide them as they choose and parcel them out. We'll come back to the question of whether or not a king can yet represent a nation, or only a dynasty, and start with the idea of subdividing England. Because there are some fault lines. The modernists do have a point. The Welsh Marches are still, in 1500, semi-autonomous regions. And there are plenty of other areas like that. So, the Palatinates of Durham and Chester. The Duchy of Lancaster. Smaller liberties actually like Bury St Edmunds, the Strand, St Albans. It feels like a bit of a patchwork. It's easy to dismiss these liberties, franchise and marches as they're variously called, as just a little local variation on the main theme, just, you know, an administrative nicety. But hang on a minute. Just listen to this. It's a chronicler's comment on the young Lord Edward, soon to be Edward I, making a visit to Chester, part of the Palatinate of Chester, obviously, possibly there for a bit of shopping. Here we go. He left Chester, and passing through Darnhill, he returned to England. Ha! Golly, that's pretty interesting. Returned to England. It would read exactly the same if he'd been coming back from France, minus any comment about the duty-free, of course. There are also regional cultural differences. So Cornwall, for example, has a different creation myth, with that story of Corineus we heard yesterday when he was given Cornwall by Brutus. It has a different language. You may also remember that in 1497, the rebelling Cornish objected to a tax designed to help the North fight off the Scots. Let the North look after that, they said. Well, that's hardly bursting with a corporate sense of love of thy English neighbour, is it? There are numerous examples of regional differences. So, for example, there's an insulting poem in the early 13th century which has a go at the people of Norfolk for being greedy, dim-witted and drunk. Opinions expressed on the history of England do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the author. London has a corporation and a very different and direct relationship with the Crown. And all of this gives grist to the modernist mill that England can't be described as one integrated political entity, that it's a patchwork of regional and local entities. And given the fact that England is pretty much the most integrated kingdom in Europe, that would put paid to any other European country making such a claim either. But in very little of this is there any implication of separatism. You will be amazed to hear it, but there are people who mock the good folk of Norfolk to this day. And we all have a hack at Guildford from time to time. With the possible exception of Yorkshire, all of these regional differences are within an English and British framework these days, and this appears to have been the same in 1500, and indeed a good deal earlier. Like all the English regions, Cornwall was connected to the wider framework by all the ties of county court, law, parliament, taxation, the same as everywhere else. The same applied to London and, of course, Norfolk. It's a feature of England that its government structures are much more consistent and coherent than most of Europe, and this has been the case since the 10th century. The situation of the Great Liberties may be slightly different, but again there's no implication anywhere that Durham fancied becoming independent of the king, or that the Crown would happily give Durham away to a family member, or even under pressure to a foreign dynasty. All these liberties and regions have a defined relationship with the Crown, their very existence only makes sense within the context of an English framework. To give another example, the Lanercost Chronicle was created at the Red Stone Abbey at Lanercost, right by Hadrian's Wall in Cumbria, and jolly nice it is too. The Chronicle is full of moaning about how the brave northern lads have been left to their devices to battle the Scots while the southern softy government doesn't understand or give them the support they need. Where have we heard that before, I wonder? Let me think. But throughout the whining, the Chronicle resolutely and unconsciously does this by identifying the interests of the North with the interests of the nation as a whole. It's like the old adage that a complaining customer is a good thing because at least they care enough to complain. More difficult is the thing actually about the importance of local loyalties to parish, local lord, county court. The problem is we simply don't have a written record from this level of society from these folks. But as with the Great Liberties, there appears to be no reason why local sentiment shouldn't have lived side by side with national. I remember one of the many impassioned debates in the Scottish independence referendum, in the interest of future-proofing, by the way, I should probably say the first Scottish independent referendum, since there may well be another. But anyway, in the first Scottish independence referendum, the Leave side managed to begin to equate unionism with a sort of lack of patriotism. You are not a proper Scot. I remember one irritated Scot rather angrily reminding everyone that it was perfectly possible to be a patriotic Scot and still believe that the Union was the best future for Scotland. The same seems to have applied in medieval England. It was perfectly possible to feel connection and loyalty to your parish or lord or county, while at the same time being loyal to England. Okay, so that's my view on two questions. As a place called England, its physical characteristics are viewed with pride. Although regions are strong and varied, there's no impetus towards separatism, and regions are all connected with central government by strong and consistent ties like court, law, taxation. Which brings us to question three, and a more cultural angle. Was it clear what it meant to be English? Was it clear how you became English? Did they have a shared story, a shared set of characteristics? In terms of legal status, by 1500 it's pretty clear that nationality is defined by where you were born, that is, birth within a particular territory. The other possibility would be by blood, i.e. because you were born to English parents, you are thereby English. As now, there's a slightly messy relationship between the two in extraordinary cases. Some of these particularly appear in the Hundred Years' War, English people born in Normandy, for example. Really, as early as the 13th and 14th century, there's a kind of package of rights you get by being English. The right to buy land in England, for example, to trade in England, that sort of thing. That's the mechanics of it. But if there was no strong sense of English nationality, you might well expect to find a pretty fluid situation. To mangle a phrase, you might expect to take the man out of England and England out of the man at the same time. What I mean is that you might expect to change your nationality as you moved around. I might go and live in France and consider myself French. But that does not seem to happen. In fact, like now, nationality was already defined whatever your legal or political changes later in life. So, some examples. A few weeks ago, we mentioned the denization process, which is reasonably well defined in the 15th century. Almost by definition, the process gave you a set of rights as though you were English, but it did not make you English. Let us take Berwick, the town, which moved in the 14th century from Scotland to England. The Scots acquired the legal rights of Englishmen, but the Scots that lived there still viewed themselves as Scottish. There's a negative argument here as well. There is a demonstrable concern, frequently and sometimes violently expressed, about foreigners living amongst the English, a worry that they pose a threat to the realm. This at very least implies a sense of loyalty to England, and also reinforces that there is a nationality called English to which you could be alien. There are far too many examples of this to go through. I refer you to the poor old Flemings and the Peasant Revolt as one example. But another set of examples actually are the monastic institutions in England owned by foreign countries, which is an interesting situation. Essentially, there were a relatively large number of religious institutions which had been endowed by French religious houses, and they sent their remittances and taxes back to their parent house in France. During the Hundred Years' War, there are questions raised in Parliament telling the king to take personal control of these places, for fear they'd pass secrets and resources to their enemies. The point of all of this is that the recognition of aliens within England supposes the existence of a recognisable Englishness. Aliens who come and live here do not become English. The fears and concerns expressed in Parliament are expressed within a national framework. They are raised in a patriotic spirit. Also, quite simply, nationality seems to matter. Whether you liked it or not, if you wanted to buy land in England, for example, you needed to prove that you were English. How far, then, did the English feel like a shared ethnic community, sharing values and culture and characteristics? A historian called A.D. Smith once organised a list of the key features that might determine a pre-modern ethnic community. They'd have a number of characteristics, he thought. They would have a collective name, a common descent myth, a shared history, a distinctive shared culture of language, religion, law, architecture and food. They'd have a specific territory and a self-conscious sense of solidarity. And certainly many of these elements are there, a shared name, law, religion, the sense of solidarity we've just talked about. But was there a shared sense of what it was to be English? A sense of English national characteristics, as it were. Well, the English view of themselves was as difficult to pin down then as it might be to do now. Go out and ask your friends for the characteristics of the English, whether you happen to be English or not. With the exception of stunningly good-looking, you'll get a range of different answers. Maybe some of them will come up more consistently than others. And it was the same in 1500. Different authors made different claims about English national characteristics, some positive, some critical. Robert of Gloucester described the English as clean and fair, and that wherever you were, you'd know them from their size. Another poet declared with some pride, "England represses sin, luxury, contempt and domination, quarrels, injustice, sorrow and injury withdraw. Peace, law and piety are reputed of her." This is nice, and it might be noted that the same poet also listed the virtues of clemency, prudence and strength. And, without a trace of irony, humility. However, all of these, and many more besides, are actually just simply a repeat of the virtues that the church spent its time telling everyone they ought to have. In fact, and unsurprisingly, they really say nothing about any distinctive national characteristic. I don't mean, by the way, to necessarily argue in favour of national characteristics. I follow the Kate Fox line of thought that such things that do exist are sociological and cultural rules, not anything derived from race or biology. But often nations do have their own conceits about themselves, do they not? You know the sort of thing. The Italians are great lovers and wear shiny suits. The French are subtle philosophers and have a relaxed attitude to life. The Irish are always up for a party, that sort of thing. If these exist amongst the English, it seems to be these. That they were good at war. That they ate too much. And that they were as likely as not to be drunk. Oh, and they had tails, by the way, which is a really odd one. We don't, just in case you're wondering. There's a comment by a Frenchman in the 14th century. "Their belly is their god. The wasteful glutton fills his gullet and stretches his stomach. He swells up and is more beast than man." Given that Edward IV seems to have been persuaded to leave his invasion of France through the judicious application of pies and pâté by the French king, this seems to have some justice in it. On a personal basis, my belly certainly believes it is a god, although I'm doing my best to reduce it to demigod status at the moment. Sometimes the English gave this a spin in presenting it as hospitality rather than gluttony, and elsewhere complained it wasn't really our fault. It was the Danes who, quote, "taught the English to drink excessively." This is a good example also, though, of the belief that these characteristics were determined by race. One of the characteristics the English shared of themselves was that they were of mixed race, and actually they didn't celebrate this, and indeed were not alone in not celebrating it. So, the chronicler, Ranulf Higden, compared the mixed English people, as he put it, to an empty stomach, wearing itself down by internal disturbances. Meanwhile, the French celebrated their own racial and linguistic purity and mocked the English for the apparent different races who went into their makeup: British, Anglo-Saxon, Norman. Having said that, the English struck back. By the way, according to the English, the French were sexually incontinent, effeminate and vain. I leave it to you to judge the fairness or otherwise of such accusations. I am sure you will judge wisely and fairly. Through all this, though, is a point that a thread running through English writers is an assumption that the peoples of the world were divided into coherent, identifiable national groups, which usually had a racial bias and a set of characteristics, which rather supports the view that the English followed the same rules. It's also the case that just as being legally given the rights of an Englishman by denization did not make you English, adopting the cultural attributes didn't either. This was a racial thing, a birth thing. It wasn't something you could put on or put off at will. So the conclusion to question three for me is that the idea of a shared, distinctively English set of characteristics is a bit shaky. But what there is plenty of evidence for is a belief in the shared creation story we talked about yesterday, that both the English and other peoples firmly believed in a set of ethnically based peoples. Legally and culturally, it's clear, once English, always English, once French, always French. And the English certainly drew a distinction between themselves and aliens, i.e. non-English. All of this, for me, paints a picture of self-awareness and a sense of difference. Which brings us to question four, the existence of a shared national language. Now, it's a reasonably commonly presented story that the 15th and 14th centuries saw the triumph of English, and that this was a core part of how the English nation was formed, that the use of vernacular in literature indicated a growth in national consciousness. It sort of assumed that English was the right language with which to express national sentiment, and that the renewed predominance of English was synonymous with the triumph of national sentiment. And there is plenty to support the view. The official takeover of English seems to start in the mid-14th century with Edward III's decision to make English the language of the courts. But it's under Henry V that it really gathers pace, and the dominance of English appears in most official documents. Meanwhile, the language and nationality are frequently conflated. So there's the super famous announcement by Edward III. This is an announcement cunningly and subtly presented just before asking the commons for money. Well, not that subtle then. Nor particularly cunning, actually, but as it happens, successful. So who cares about subtle and cunning? What Edward did was to present a document to Parliament revealing a plot by the evil French king to, quote, destroy the whole English nation and tongue. It's an approach which crops up from time to time, actually, over the next century, three or four times. It tells us that the English language was, to an extent, seen as a symbol of English nationality. To destroy the language was to destroy the people. It also shows us, incidentally, while we're on it, that Edward politically thought it worth appealing to national sentiment when he wanted people to part with their hard-earned cash. So fine, all sounds like a great story. But all of this is not perhaps quite as definitive as you might suppose. Because the first thing is that the English recognised that their language was a mixed affair from a number of different races. And they felt that, as the French lost no time in telling them, that this made it less an object worthy of pride. So you don't get all that dreamy, oh, the language of Shakespeare, and reams of statistics about the length of Winston Churchill's vocabulary. Good Lord, no. Partly because neither Winston nor Shakespeare were yet alive, but my point is that English itself was not at the time viewed as superior in character. French and Latin, in particular, continued to be used, and in fact seen as perfectly acceptable languages in which to express national sentiment. On the other hand, it wasn't necessary to have writing in English to demonstrate a national style of literature. The English-authored romances were written in French, actually, but they were clearly based on English or at least British traditions of Arthur and all of that, and therefore they were seen as distinctively English, no matter they'd been written in French. A further argument often used has been that by speaking French, the nobility must have found it difficult to share a sense of nationality with their English-speaking population. So, a sort of fault line across the nation. But in fact, French often formed a common language for a very wide range of people that cut across the different English dialects. The French spoken by the English nobles was mocked by the French for its odd accent, and there appears to have been no difficulty in the English nobility feeling English while speaking French. One final point is that any kind of literacy was still the preserve of the elite. So Chaucer's use of the vernacular, Henry V's use of the vernacular in his circulars home about his glorious victories, have both been seen as expanding communication more broadly to the people, as it were. And to an extent that's true, but remember, we're still talking about a relatively small proportion of our total population with those literacy skills. So in thinking about question four then, the importance of language and whether that demonstrates a sense of English national consciousness, well yes, there's no doubt that in the 14th and 15th century, the use of English is transformed. And to a degree, it's seen as a symbol. But English, French and Latin remain a core part of English life. It doesn't appear to have been necessary for people to speak or write English to feel English. Patriotism could be expressed through any of these languages. Question 5 was about the church, and it's one of the biggest objections to a shared sense of English nationalism, that the church was a supranational organisation, that its very essence before the Reformation was to stress uniformity rather than national boundaries and differences. And it does not do to underestimate how important this is, though it's a little tricky to really grasp with the modern mindset. Maybe it helps to think of Emperor Henry IV kneeling in the snow to beg the forgiveness of Pope Gregory VII at Canossa. The popes had been able to enforce their supremacy over the most mighty of rulers in the 11th century. Or John, giving his country to the Pope and doing homage to the Pope for England. Maybe it helps to think, on a completely different scale, of the priest leading his parishioners around the fields to bless them, or the churching of a new mother to understand the importance of the church in most people's daily lives, so much more present and more immediate than the presence of kings. Or maybe it helps to think of Thomas More in 1535, who would go to his death, specifically because he believed that one part of the church, England, could not make a decision without the agreement of the whole body of the church. For Thomas More, the supranational church absolutely trumped this local, regional loyalty. But by the 15th century, things were very different politically than they'd been in the 11th. Popes had been humbled by France and gone through the schism and the Babylonian captivity in Avignon. In England, successive kings had passed Act of Provisors. These acts of provisor restricted the Pope's right to appoint, let's say, an Italian bishop to a benefice in England. Appointments like this were fundamental to the concept of a supranational church, so if national boundaries mean nothing, why on earth would it matter which part of Christendom your priest came from? After all, the Mass is in an international language. So politically, with things like the Act of Provisors, things have moved on a bit. But that doesn't mean that the minds of the English people had moved on, and that emotional loyalty to the church outweighed loyalty to king. So remember that in Jean Breuil's definition, in the nationalist state, loyalty to the nation came first. So it would be handy to look at the role of the English church as well as its relationship to the state. And when you do this, it's really hard to look at the church as anything other than a national church in practice. And if we go forward 40 years, Henry VIII will embed this concept in law and do so with surprisingly little difficulty and resistance. And not only in most practical matters does the English church dance to the tune of the state, it actively supports the state and a national message. By the 14th century, the phrase Ecclesia Anglicana is increasingly used in official documents, the English church, as though the English bit of the church is a distinct entity. By the 14th century, the ability of kings to appoint to the church would have made poor old Pope Gregory turn in his grave and Emperor Henry IV jump for joy. One of the delightful things about the break with Rome and Protestantism in England in the 16th and 17th century is that God becomes an Englishman. I have never claimed the English were modest. The English considered themselves as God's chosen people. Seriously, I never said the English were modest. However, there are signs of this very thing much earlier than the Reformation, or at least that the church actively uses its influence and capabilities to promote the concept of a unique English identity. It uses its authority and influence to enforce the power and authority of the English state. For example, in documents, God is all over the place, in really boring stuff, it has to be said. Did God really want to appear, for example, in a wool subsidy in 1381, which was granted by the Commons, quote, for the honour of God, a hamidutz, that God did indeed feel so honoured? Victory, of course, was attributed to God. On the fall of Berwick to Edward III, he ordered a service to thank, quote, our Saviour, who in his mercy gave us victory. Now, of course, this is commonplace, and every king and secular government was at this sort of thing, claiming God was on their side. The point is, though, that it works the other way around as well. Official church rhetoric also has God and the church supporting the authority of the state. It's a bit unsurprising, actually. The church was a career in the Middle Ages, not necessarily a vocation, although sometimes, of course, it could be. But if you were a younger son, it was probably the very best career open to you. So the leaders of the church were essentially very rich, very powerful managers, rather than, let's say, deeply holy and possibly unworldly men of the early Roman church, for example. So in 1369, the convocation of the church was summoned by the Archbishop of Canterbury because of, quote, the great and undisguised necessity concerning the estate of the Lord our King and the kingdom. But again, this is not necessarily distinctively English, but then that emerges too. During the Black Death, it is the English people for whom prayers were ordered, for example. And in this way, we will rescue the English people from tribulations. Tribulations, it has to be said, would seem to be a relatively understated way of referring to the death of 50% of the population, but there you go, early signs maybe of the English stiff upper lip. This more negative example, though, again demonstrates that the base assumption was that the English existed as a distinct unit. Retribution and prayers to mitigate the sins of the English, rather than the sins of people in general or Christendom in general. These are commonplace. So here's one sermon of the time. If our enemies trouble we English on all sides, if we who used to be victors are oppressed and captured on all sides, surely we suffer this because we sin. From this it was but a step to England as the promised land and to the elect. The idea of England as the promised land had been around for a while. Here's chronicler Henry of Huntingdon in the 12th century. That isle surpasses all others which God rules in fertile fields, milk and honey. But in 1377, the Chancellor and Bishop of St. David's, Adam Horton, was a lot more specific. And thus you have what the scripture calls peace over Israel, for which Israel is to be understood as the inheritance of God, which is England. For truly I believe that God would never have honoured this land in the manner he did Israel, by great victories over their enemies, if he had not chosen it for his inheritance. So, England as God's chosen. Now there's no doubt that as a theme this gets much stronger after the Reformation, but from the 14th century there it is. The English, God's chosen. Again, I never claimed the English were humble. It was that Robert of Gloucester bloke who said the English were the most humble nation ever, could out-humble anyone, just bring it on and we'll be the humblest, no sweat, and all that sort of stuff. There were other ways in which the church in England really behaved as a church of England. One of these were processions and church services in support of the state, in celebration of battle won or lost, for example. As it happens, they were very poorly attended, but hey, it's the thought that count. What all of this boils down to is that the church supported the idea of the Kingdom of England as a sort of spiritual and moral unit, a separate entity with its own characteristics and for which the church had a responsibility to support its welfare by keeping it in God's favour. There's more, in fact, because the church also provided part of England's story. Now there's that largely secular one in Brutus and Arthur we've talked about, the arrival of a dramatically religious one in the English as the chosen people one, but the church also gave England some of its most distinctive symbols in its national saints and supported the veneration of those saints as part of the England story. And in a way there are three bits to this thing. One is that England claimed special ownership of the 15th century's most popular saint, Mary, whose cult outstrips all others throughout Christendom. So you've got, for example, Richard II's painting, The Wilton Diptych, which has England as Mary's dowry. And then you've got England's indigenous saints, St. Edmund the Martyr, for example, St. Edward the Confessor, St. Ethelreda. These were saints, both church and monarchy, espoused. But the biggest one, really the most significant, is the patron saint of England, St. George. Lord knows why George got chosen as England's patron saint. Well, we can give some explanation. But it has as much cultural resonance as singing Sweet Chariot at an England rugby international. Because George was a martyred Cappadocian soldier of the late 3rd century, chosen as patron at various times also by Ethiopia, Germany, Portugal and Armenia, and a few towns as well. And yet Edward I in 1277 decided he was the perfect choice on Welsh campaign of that year, in the first example of the use of the Red Cross symbol in a nationally sponsored context. Edward II, meanwhile, didn't give George the rough end of a pineapple, unlike Edward III, who really went for it, by choosing St. George as the patron of his new Order of the Garter. For Edward, St. George was an act of cultural warfare against the French, and to some degree the adoption of a soldier makes sense in the context of the chivalric Order of the Garter. And it can be argued that through the reigns of Edward III and Edward IV, St George was more a royal than a national symbol. But a saint chosen for a chivalric and military purpose under Henry V became fully established as a national rallying figure. Henry consciously promoted the saint as England's patron, using the Red Cross on soldiers' clothing and calling on George's help at Agincourt, for example. George's cult from there moved into the guilds and became a major religious feast in 1461. The proliferation of images in churches indicates St George's adoption by the upper classes. It's less sure this covers the mass of folks too, but they would surely have been fully exposed to all those images. So church-wise, question 5, it seems to me, is a pretty strong story. The English church looks, feels and smells like a national church. It provides images and moral support to the nation against other parts of Christendom. In practical terms, the king exercises political control over much of the church's activities. Religious symbols, notably a patron saint, provide unique national symbols. It's a wrap. Which brings us finally to the last question. Was there an active political community? As part of this, we should also consider the difference or otherwise between royal interests and national interests. Because it would not be too hard to argue that much of this stuff was simply in the interests of the king and his family, landowners of England as it were, especially in the reigns of the earlier Normans, rather than in the interests of a people and a nation. Well, I'm so glad we brought that up, because it's during this period that both kings and the political community appear to make a distinction between the two, between the king's interests and the national interest. Edward I's official pronouncements clearly separated his interests, expressed as the king's honour, and national interests, expressed in terms of the kingdom's welfare. In the time of Edward II, a critical principle is established. Now, Edward II was quite obviously God's gift to hedging and ditching, but was equally obviously a complete stinker when it came to the business of being a king. This gave the nobility, the king's natural supporters, something of a problem. No, they wanted a king, but they just didn't want this particular king. And so, before one of them got round to sticking a red-hot poker, where the sun doesn't shine, they told him that they were loyal. Phew, said Edward, that's good news. That they were loyal to the crown, they said, not necessarily to this specific wearer. Ah, said Edward. Thus the king's role became identified as national rather than a purely personal and dynastic role. The Hundred Years' War also helped in this respect, of allowing successive kings to present the national effort, expressed in the form of taxation and war, as a national necessity and defence of the national interest for res publica, the public interest. There is then a critical moment in the reign of Edward III when he decided to claim the French throne. Good Lord, said the English Parliament. Obviously, King, you know, we're terribly supportive of anything you do, but gosh, France, huh? Big phrase, France, full of French. Us English wouldn't want to get swallowed up by a bunch of Frenchmen, you know. Would you mind awfully signing this document? The document concerned was a declaration that the English would never be ruled by the French or be subject to French laws, if Edward III actually went and won the French throne. That if he did, it would be effectively a separate dual monarchy. Quite clearly, England is established as a separate, indivisible unit. This is reinforced in the 14th and 15th century by the concept of subjecthood, whose definition narrows somewhat. So subjects of the English crown become restricted to the English specifically. While the French provinces remain, the Gascons owe allegiance to their duke, not the English king. The point I'm making is that the role of the King of England has become separate to the person of the King of England, that the English king and the English nation have become the same thing. It's a public role, as it were. The fact that Edward III, for example, was also Lord of Ireland, Duke of Gascony, is irrelevant as far as the nation of England is concerned. Okay, so that separates king and the person of the king, but what about the national political discourse? John Bray's definition of political sovereignty implies a level of political involvement by the wider population, a national debate, as it were, a national conversation. Is there any evidence of this? So on one hand, there is quite a bit of that, in that by the 14th century, English kings are consciously appealing to the wider nation, not just their nobility. So there's the famous call to action in English in defence of their language against the French threat we talked about earlier. Henry V's open letters to the nation, for example, during the Hundred Years' War. But the problem is that there's simply no evidence of a response or any evidence of the level of engagement by the wider population outside the elite. It's perfectly possible to construct an argument that has all of this stuff we've talked about going on, or at least much of it, like sort of the turbulent surface of the ocean, the waves crashing and heaving above, while in the dark, cold depths, normal life goes on, a procession of harvests and religious festivals, as a largely illiterate population concentrated what was important to them, parish, church, family, lord, the game on a Saturday night. The vast majority of all the preceding arguments in this podcast and the previous is all based on literary evidence, which by definition in 1500 means the elite. We simply cannot hear the voice of the peasant. Having said that, there is a smidgen of evidence of popular engagement, but it is titchy. So, the English elite themselves claim that their system was unusually inclusive for the standards of the time it was. The famous jurist John Fortescue in the 15th century argued that the English gave their obedience to the king more willingly because they were consulted and gave assent to his rule. He reminded the French king that, quote, God made not his people for princes, but he made princes for his service and the weal of his people. Now that's an interesting quote. The purpose of the king is for the wealth of his people. That's not the way the Roman inheritance has it. Outside of the Germanic world, there's no implication of this sort of bottom-up approach of authority and purpose drifting up from the people. It's all top-down, thank you very much. The king and the emperor in his right, and the people there to do his bidding. In 1509, Edmund Dudley, dark servant of a dark and now dead prince in Henry VII, was arrested and waiting for judgment in the Tower. Now, our Dudders was in contrite mood. He wrote a rather fascinating document outlining some of the things he'd done, and he also wrote this. As subjects are bounden to their prince, so do all kings be bounden to their subjects, by the commandment of God for them to maintain and support. For though the people be subjects to the king, yet they are the people of God, and God hath ordained their prince to protect them, and they to obey their prince. In this, and the development of the theory of the Commonwealth as a definer of the nature of the state, is there some evidence of greater popular engagement? It's going too far to suggest that there is yet any theory that the king derives his authority from the people, but there is just a suggestion now that the prince should rule in the interests of his subjects. And thereby, people are included to an extent in the political process. Another area to consider is the appeal to the populace in the Wars of the Roses. Regular appeals for support were made publicly by factions to the people. Think of Warwick and his populism. The views of towns in particular mattered through their influence in Parliament. Now, I am not going to argue that Parliament was a genuinely representative body. It's clearly an organ of the propertied classes. One historian had called it a selection process rather than election process, reflecting that what happened was that the great men got together as often as not and decided who all the tenants would vote for this time round, and who'd get a trip to London. Parliaments are remarkably obedient all the way through the Wars of the Roses. But, there is a background of popular involvement in the proclamations and appeals of the drama of London closing its gates to Margaret and opening them to Edward, which surely must have included the engagement at least of the inhabitants of the towns. And at the same time, literacy in the 15th century had spread significantly. So look, there are a couple of examples of a wider political debate outside the elite, which give the suggestion of a kind of engaged political community the modernist historian considered critical to a nationalist state. But I'm having to work hard. In this, I think, is the Achilles heel of the argument that England does indeed have a strong sense of national consciousness. We simply can't know if the average man and the woman labouring in the field shared this sense of English nationality and had a view on the latest political goings-on. Though we can probably assert with some confidence that England was closer to such engagement than most of the medieval European nations outside Italian city-states and Flemish cities. Good golly, I am exhausted. So that's a lot of stuff. Shall we summarise, ladies and gentlemen, and decide where we've got to? My own view is that on most measures, medieval England enjoyed a distinct national character and sense of consciousness. If we quickly review our tests, Look, there's a pretty clearly defined territory, bit fuzzy around the edges when you look closely. There's a distressing tendency to get England mixed up with Britain, but every English person thought they knew where it was. Regional loyalties there in spade, but always in the context of the greater interests of England. As far as we can tell, the people of England identified themselves as English. They might whine about northerners, southerners, but both squabbled within the context of the best interests of England. The rather unattractive xenophobia is evidence also of nationalism. There was a role of the king which was specific to England, rather than simply any old person. England has a clear, recognisable mythology, and a story that would have made Sellers and Yeatman proud. The question about language turns out to be less critical than you might think. Actually, by 1500, English is triumphant, but even then it seems perfectly reasonable to express national sentiment in other languages. Multiple languages seem to be perfectly compatible with English nationalism. The English church, in practice, plays a role that on a day-to-day level is indistinguishable from that of a national church. Before long, the theoretical exceptions will have disappeared as well. As for the political community, this for me is the fly in the ointment, the complete inability to judge whether these sentiments went any further through the social scale than the gentry and the educated. There's simply no evidence. Nonetheless, we do know that the level of political engagement is widening. So the conclusion for me is that in all likelihood, in England, we have a nation at this time, a nation with a shared sense of identity and loyalty to some greater whole. In 1500, England stood on the threshold of a century that would test that loyalty more than ever, and it will not be found wanting. Good golly, Miss Molly, I am so pleased to have got that off my chest. I feel like a different person. Next time, ladies and gents, we have the history of a very different nation. We are ready to kick off the story of Scotland. See you then.